ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to Away, Indigenous Art and Culture on ABCRN. Rudy Bremer with you. Today, self-determination and native ingredients. Chef Mark Olive, education consultant Priscilla Reid-Loynes, and IndigiEarth founder Sharon Windsor join you to discuss why native ingredients are good for our land, bodies, and soul. And why so little of the native food market is Aboriginal owned.
I can't explain the feelings that I felt when I watched my mum make Johnny cakes using native grains for the first time up on Gomeroi country. It was such an emotional time watching my mum, thinking, wow, she has not done this in her lifetime. But in this very moment, we are standing together as Gomeroi Uwaliai women, and we've reclaimed that practice.
Then, for Word Up, you'll join Shay Kelly in Kununurra for one last time as he shares the Mirrawong word for hair. Stay with me here on Away. Have you ever had lemon myrtle damper? Do you go yabbying with your cousins? What about cooking up an emu steak? In 2022, the bush food industry was worth around $80 million, and that figure is expected to double by next year. But as the popularity of native food surges, who is actually benefiting? To find out, I'm joined by three people, each incredibly knowledgeable when it comes to native foods. Sharon Windsor is a Ngamba Wailuan woman from Western New South Wales and the founder of IndigiEarth, a business dedicated to selling ethically sourced and sustainably harvested bush foods. Sharon's been working in this space for 28 years and has been advocating for native ingredients long before they were celebrated in the culinary world. We're also joined by Chef Mark Olive, also known as the Black Olive. He's a Bundjalung man born on Ngarrawal country and the owner of the restaurant Midden at the Sydney Opera House. Mark's worked in TV for a lot of his career, so you probably know him from programs like The Outback Cafe or The Chef's Line. And we have education consultant and creative Priscilla Reid-Loynes, a Gamilaroi Uwalaray Innar from Walgett, northwest New South Wales. Priscilla does community work with the University of Sydney's Native Grains Research Program to ensure the interests of Gomeroi people are at the forefront of the work. So let's begin this discussion at the source. Sharon, ethically sourced is one of those terms people use a lot, but what does it actually mean in the scope of native food?
For me, it's really important that the places and the people that I'm working with across the country are doing the right thing by Mother Earth. So for me, growing up on country, out in the bush, surviving off the land, thriving on native foods as a child, maintaining those processes and also maintaining cultural connection to country through food.
Priscilla, you've been invited as a guest of Sydney University and the CSIRO's Native Grains Research Project. So you sit on the oversight committee with other Gamilaroi community members. I'm wondering what your involvement with that project looks like.
So I have a cousin, Rhonda Ashby, who sits on the oversight committee at the moment, and she's been on that committee since the beginning of the project. And so my involvement has been being able to sample the beautiful grains and be reintroduced to them in that in the form of flour and then using it with my family, but also then having the opportunity to go up to the farm space where they grow the grains and then to collect and gather those grains and experience that process and I guess reclaim those processes as Gomeroi women working with the grains in the way our old people have always worked with them.
Mark, you've been an ambassador for aquaculture stewardship for a number of years and last year worked with them to create an Easter cookbook that showcased sustainable seafood recipes. What role do you see waterways and sea country playing in this discussion?
Oh, look, I think it's huge because to sustainably obtain, you know, good seafood and to farm it basically so it's at a peak where it's, you know, at its best. I think, you know, the way that they do it is sustainable. But not only that, the product is a good product. It's not like a lot of farmed stuff these days where, you know, you get the barramundi money that's like mud. It's just hideous. So there's a lot of stuff now that they're addressing, and that is one of them, that the food is sustainable, but not only that, of the regions, and the flesh is a lot better, basically. That's what I find. And, yeah, I think that's where we're heading, especially with that farm stuff, when we're trying to feed a lot of people and to have good proteins and to have good nutrition, it's a good way to do it. So hopefully it'll get better.
Do you think that it is synonymous with sustainable food production when we're talking about native foods?
I think it depends who you're talking to.
Mm.
And who's growing it or who's farming it or who's harvesting it. So it depends. When we're talking to other mob around the country, yes. When we're talking to the non-Aboriginal growers in the space, that's a different perspective there.
Mm. I mean, do you mind unpacking a little why you think that is?
I think it's historically different farming practices. So some of the big kind of commercial growers of native ingredients have come from an agricultural background anyway and may have changed farming of European foods, wheat, cotton, whatever, into native foods, but they still carry some of those methods of farming and how they work the land into native ingredients. There's a lot of them that I know that have done great with reaching out to community, their local community and elders, and inviting them to come and help heal country and, you know, change the way that they are doing things agriculturally in that space, which has been really good. But, yeah, there's quite a different perspective on knowledge of farming country between people, yeah.
Priscilla, like, I might throw this to you of, like, what would you say to people that argue landscape has changed so much that it's not actually viable to produce native grain?
Absolutely, the landscape has changed. But that's not to say that we can't work with it, that we can't regenerate country in good ways. And I guess, you know, when we're thinking about those practices of harvesting and gathering of native foods, you know, what we have to remember is that our people have always had ceremony in those spaces, right? And you only ever took what you needed to take to feed your family, and you had consideration for everything that would be in relationship to, you know, in this case, the grasses or to the fish. So it is possible, but obviously we do have issues around climate change and around how land has been changed from farming practices. And also when we think about water, where water goes, where water is taken out of river systems, what goes into river systems. So we've got to take all of those things into consideration. But if we can work in ethical ways that where we have that relationship with the earth, and in Gomeroi, you know, we say Gunima, what is our relationship with Gunima? Are we in right relationship? Are we in reciprocity? Because what nurtures us, we have to nurture it back. That's the right relationship. So when we take, can we honour those plants or the animals and be mindful in that relationship? So we can do better.
What grains are we talking about here?
So I guess up on Gomeroi we've got a whole range of grains, but at the moment I'd be thinking about the Gunalay and the Gully. So beautiful, the tiniest seeds, and they're hard work to harvest, but they're the two that are coming to mind for me at the moment.
It's like the daisy yams down along, you know, Gisborne in the whole Victorian area.
Yes.
Right up along there, very starchy, really, really nice. But, yeah, no, it's interesting just seeing here where some of these grains come from, because I know with the Kwandong seed, the mm-hmm. seed inside the seed can be used as a grain because it's quite tasty, and it can be used as a flour. But I tell you what, you'd be out there for years to get a kilo off it. But it was used. So, yes. Yeah, it's interesting.
Well, even the, you know, Lamandra seeds, right, that makes a flour.
Mm.
You can make bread with that. And again, like that's spiky. Like if you want to get that, right, that's hard work.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
even with the grasses, right, you've got to know how to read that country and look around, because they're high grains, that grasses that grow up to your waist.
Yeah.
There's a lot of snakes in that grass, you know. So.
And it was snake season too.
So, I mean, we've been talking about sort of the potential of native foods, and I think what was really interesting, Mark, when you were asking about what grains in particular, I think people have a very narrow idea of what native foods actually are, whether they're thinking about just in terms of meat, like emu and kangaroo, which lovely, but not the only thing.
Mm. Oh, there's all sorts of seafoods, crustaceans and, you know, all sorts of stuff. And it's the same with the aquaculture, that model of, you know, sustainability and doing that properly is on the same, you know, steps with the grains. Do it properly, get it out there and, you know, teach and help the community and the future of these kids to really have a career in something attached to their culture. In the end, it's that full circle. And I hope as our elders, as we are now, shocking to say, but we hope to depart some of that information. And especially with, you know, especially with the food side of what I've been doing over the decades, it's been interesting to see a lot of Indigenous kids come through to learn about their own culture, but their food in their own culture and where they, you know, I mean, now you can just get it on the internet and have a look. In the day, for me, it was in libraries, going out to communities, sitting in Mitchell Library for days, harvesting and foraging people's front yards through Sydney. So
I was doing that last week.
That where I've got a few bushes near the airport. So you might see me out there rattling with a with a blanket one day. But it's amazing the seafood, but not only that, the actual fruits that are around Sydney, the lily pillies, the magenta lily pillies, and people are just so unaware. They just think they're, you know, just a ornamental shrub or something, you know.
I was collecting some last week, had my little brother Harley with me, and in the back of my ute, side of the street, collecting, picking all this lily pilly, and everyone was just looking at us like we were idiots, until lady come out of the house and she goes, can I just ask, what are you doing? And had no idea. Yeah. And there's actually got over 100 kilos of fruit out of that one street, and there's still heaps more there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know they're out there. So, I mean, the idea is to use it and utilise it and teach people. So I think once you get that message across, it, you know, works.
Because Sharon, you are also a chef. Yes. So, like, how do you challenge people to think about native ingredients in a broader way? Like, how to to open up what that as a term actually is.
Compared to...
There's a big story behind this.
Yeah. I did start my journey commercially in business 28 years ago, and I was living in Western Sydney. And so when I first started business, and what led me to starting business was I missed being out bush so much. I missed the food. I missed everything about it. And every time I'd talk to somebody about the five corners and go and collect and like lots of different things and eating the sap off the trees and everything, people thought I was an idiot. Like they were like, what are you talking about? Like we have no idea. And then I started talking about, well, I want to do catering and I want to, you know, teach people this. And people's thoughts back then was, they thought I was going to drag a goanna out behind me or something. And the only thing that bush food could be would be witchetty grubs and a goanna or something. And so it's slowly changed over the years, but it's still a long way to go. People still have very limited mindset of what native foods are. And when you tell them that there's, you know, we've got thousands of edible native species in this country, it blows their mind. They have no idea. So I like being able to educate people through that food process in lots of different ways and in lots of different capacities. And for me, over the years, it's been about breaking down different menu ideas or different products into things that people would commonly use at home. So if they're buying a jam and that's, you know, making a native fruit jam, and so people are more likely to try it, and then it slowly gets them sort of interested. And then also, you know, around the health benefits that come along with a lot of our ingredients as well.
Definitely the nutritional value of a lot of the stuff is really, you know, it's high class, and it's superfoods these days, things like the Kakadu plum. You've got the Illawarra, you've got the Davidson plum, you've got all of these different types of fruits and the quandongs, the vitamin C, how nutritional and all this stuff is that people are just starting to learn now. And like, you know, Sharon in the 90s, in the 80s, it was like scarce, you know. It was like you walk down the street and you could hear crickets. People just didn't know about bush foods or bush tucker, and all they thought about was kangaroo. And the thing is, kangaroo wasn't decriminalised until 1993. So before that, it was just pet food. Mm. And I mean, Christ, we used to eat it, make burgers out of the pet food. But I mean, it's fine. And I think a lot of people miss that brief, you know, during that time, that it was an edible protein that was very good for you. So after 93, people started jumping on board, and it took a long time, and it's only now that it's really being discovered as a great protein, like the emu, because, like, and I say this all the time to everybody and every time I present, for Indigenous people, these were never our coat of arms. They were viable food, protein, and a nutritional source, part of our dream times and storytelling. So, you know, a lot of people balk it because we eat our coat of arms. Well, boo-hoo. They're a great protein. And, yes, we're the only country in the world that eats their own, you know, coat of arms.
It was our food long before it was a coat of arms.
Exactly. So, you know, once you start telling those stories and you tell it to a huge crowd and people overseas, the light comes on and they get it. But you shouldn't have to get to that point where you're talking about a culture and a specific food within that culture. Australia is on the back foot of that brief, and I think we have to step up now and get beyond that. Mm-hmm. Because I tell you what, it's cheaper than lamb. Who wants to go out and pay $60 for a, you know, a leg of lamb? I don't.
No.
Well, I mean, price is an interesting thing because I know that I've spoken with blackfellas in Tasmania, for instance, who've talked about when they were growing up eating abalone because they were catching it themselves and nobody actually wanted it. It was considered, they were too poor to go and buy something in the shop, and it's a good source of protein and it's there. And now the price of abalone is so high that it's almost unattainable for them as, like,
Yeah, I think the Palaroo mob have had a bit of a bad deal. Even the Cape Barren geese that goes down there, part of the whole culture down there. I mean, that was a great protein. And that goose, it's so fatty and lovely. It's, you know, another thing that, I don't know, you feel like you get screwed over sometimes, you know?
So we've been talking about some of the challenges that come with using native ingredients in the culinary world, how the ingredients weren't taken seriously for a long time and now are seen as pretty valuable and in a lot of cases quite expensive. But I want to know what the impact of that trendiness is. Like, what are some of the pitfalls of native ingredients being on our menus?
I guess there's some places where people, whether it's cafe or restaurant or catering or whatever it is, that are using and embracing native ingredients, but they're not actually doing it the right way to play justice to those ingredients. So it's there just for marketing purposes or for the to be able
for
to
the
say
aesthetics
yeah,
of it all.
Yeah.
It's a bit of window shopping on a plate.
Yeah.
But what are, you know, things yeah. like the sea parsley is you use instead of a parsley, you know. It looks like parsley, so you use it, but it tastes a bit different. So using all of these different things like the succulents, you've got the samphires, you've got the ice plants, you've got the calcula now. So all of these things are unique. And we do use them down at the Midden. So it's important because, you know, they have a story to tell as well in location, of place, of story. So, you know, again, you have these interesting things on a plate and people say, oh, you know, where is this from and, you know, how can you use this? And but it's trying the textures and the flavour of these succulents, which is really surprising for a lot of people. And same with our, you know, the leafy greens with the river mints and also the toxic warrigal green. So blanch it first. But it's interesting. You know, you can use a lot of these things and the actual fruits just as a garnish as well. So, again, I think it's about learning and it's about just getting it out there.
Oh, you can do it. If it's done well, it's done well and it's good. But then there's people that aren't doing it well and it's just there for the purposes of nothing, and it's not even like for sharing a story or for educating people. So there's a difference between doing it well and not doing it well and doing it for the wrong reasons.
I do have a peeve though. Sometimes you go to restaurants that says, you know, we've got this ingredient and you really have to search for it. You can't taste it. Or you look at it, okay, well, where is it? What are you looking, you know, you say it's on the menu.
I've questioned a few
places
where
I've
gone. I've
bailed a few places up.
That have, yeah, can't. And my kids have even said, I think they just wave that plate over a lemon myrtle leaf, Mum, because there's nothing there. And so it's that kind of thing. Or people saying that there's finger lime in it and there's nothing at all that's native. There's some sort of lime on there, but it's not native. And, yeah, so there's doing it well and there's not doing it at all. And then there's...
Yeah, you've really got to understand the flavours, the textures, but not only that, the visual aspect of what, you know, Indigenous food is as well, to tell that story. Hence, you put a bit of parsley on a plate. No, it's sea parsley. This is the story. It's from South Australia. It's got these different tones. It's got these different flavours. And you taste it. So, yeah, that place and all of that sort of stuff.
Priscilla, I wanted to ask you, because we've been talking a little about how the attitude of native foods has changed in terms of proteins. But when it comes to Aboriginal knowledge being intertwined with native foods, we've known how to grow these grains for thousands of years, but that knowledge has not necessarily been respected or I'm curious, like, what impact did that sort of silencing have, if that makes sense?
Yeah, so for community and, and accessibility, right?
Yes.
Like, I mean, I can only ever speak from my own lived experience. And so my experience is, as a child, I clearly remember those grasses or the native grains. You know, we'd play in them, we'd pick them, they'd become a part of our games in the mud pies and all those kinds of things that we do as children, but never knew that they were the grass or the seed that was used to make bread, right? And it's only, you know, in the last few years that we've been able to reclaim that space and reclaim that relationship with it and go, hang on, we need to be working with these grains, and this is, you know, all this land has got all these seeds. How can we gather that as women in community so that, you know, we can use the grains in the way our grandmothers used those grains. And I'm talking about like out west in northwest New South Wales, Walga, Lightning Ridge, because they're along the rivers, they're along the roads, but also they're in places where you don't have access because they're somebody's property. And so, you know, to have access to them again is, I can't explain the feelings that I felt when I watched my mum make Johnny cakes using native grains for the first time up on Gomeroi country. And then I took my mum a couple of weeks ago to the Sydney Uni space, to the community day, and I watched my mum, who's 70, turning 71, I watched her collect the grasses, collecting those seeds. And it was such an emotional time watching my mum, thinking, wow, she has not done this in her lifetime. But in this very moment, we are standing together as Gomeroi Ualiai women, and we've reclaimed that practice in that moment, you know. And I've got goosebumps, but I hope that's what everyone gets to do, you know, because the feeling you get, the wellness that came from standing there and just watching how people gathered the grains, even as a community, you know, there were lots of mob from Walga that were standing there gathering those. And I looked up and I thought, how beautiful all my mob, half of them were our mob, we're standing there, you know, collecting these grains. and you know, and I loved our one cousin, he goes, oh, this is hard work, this, you know, and he walks off. And it just reminded me and made me think about how as community we stand together, we take each other along in these spaces so that we can reclaim the practices that were, you know, I always think that, you know, they've been disrupted, but they've always been there in the land. The grasses never went anywhere. The grain was changed, you know, from the native seeds to the wheat. But the other part in that was, you know, our women never stopped making bread, and they never stopped sharing the bread with the rest of community. Whatever we've had, we've always shared that with everybody. So I think the wellness aspect, those cultural components of you know, what goes into making bread and gathering and the sharing of our food as community, that has never changed. It was just our access to the grasses and the grains that was disrupted.
The other thing too, like talking about, you know, this disruption and what's happening, and then the other lots of other people coming into the industry, and it's something that I've been talking about the last couple of weeks at attending the Prime Minister's event in Melbourne, the ASEAN event, and then yesterday again in Melbourne at the AsiaLink Leaders Forum, is about the native food industry and what's happening and our people that haven't been in control of that, and that we need to be at the forefront of that industry. We need to be the storytellers of our destination and our future, and on all levels of the food, the native food industry, and that we're only made up of 2% ownership of the industry. Less than 2% Aboriginal ownership is of the native food industry. And so having these practices back on country for our women and our kids, for everyone, for language purposes, for cooking, for learning, everything is so important that we lead, and we need to be the forefront of this industry.
Tell you what, in the day, it was like hen's teeth when I was around, and to actually find people to actually engage with. I mean, it wasn't a movement like it is today. And to go back 45 years, it was tough to do that research, to listen to my elders and go back to the mission up at Cabo and, you know, look at the wattle seeds and all of the backhouses up there and all the other acacias that were growing there that then I found down on the south coast on Darug land where I live now. So there was nobody around back then, and it was hard work. Got a bit of few swollen lips eating this and that, but I mean, it was an education, you know, and I'm so happy now that there's a lot of other people doing this sort of stuff, because it validates our cuisine, it validates our culture, but not only that, it's an understanding, I think, for everybody to understand that this is a viable product and produce. So it's just stepping up now and really taking it to the next level and getting that opportunity to do it. because I know I'm going to be dead sooner or later, and they're all still coming through, and I'm glad, you know, because when I'm tired, but I've been doing this a long time, and I just I think it's time for me to slow down a bit. I wish, but no, there's still good things to come.
You're listening to Away, Indigenous Art and Culture on ABCRN. I'm Rudy Bremer, and right now I'm joined by Chef Mark Olive, Education Consultant Priscilla Reid-Loynes, and IndigiEarth founder Sharon Windsor. We're discussing native foods. Priscilla, I want to jump back into something you mentioned earlier about making bread with your mum. It really struck me. We often talk about native foods in terms of health in our bodies, but when you said that it was also about wellness, it got me thinking about how healthy it is for us culturally to have this knowledge. So, Mark and Sharon, did that resonate with you?
Oh, for me personally, my, you know, starting business with food was because I missed being home so much, and that's what led me to it. But then it turned into my healing, and forever will be my healing. So when I was 21, I lost my first baby. He was stillborn, and I went full term with him. So when depression took over my life, you know, I couldn't function from one day to another. And then when I did pick up business again 6 months later, just to do a few things, and I started feeling better, and I realized that it actually wasn't because I was doing commercial business. It was because I was practicing culture through business with food. And so that was the beginning of my healing process. And then 16 years ago, I went through some pretty horrific domestic violence, and it was a pretty bad time of my life. And so it continued on from there. And so I never, ever intended to, I guess, do as much as I have in commercial business, because food for me has been my healing and what I do with food and botanicals. So it's that cultural healing. It's lots of different things, you know, health benefits as well, being with family, being on country, and everything in between.
I think for me it was quite different, because being, I think, at that forefront, going out to communities, spending a lot of time with the aunties and cooking. And once I started being on ABC, I was invited into all of these different communities and to spend time with them, to understand their cuisine, their stories and their culture, you know, because we're in different countries everywhere.
Mm.
And so it was a big learning curve, but not only that, it was more about not being a commercial operator. It was a passion. That was my passion, about food and about teaching and about culture and about understanding the food. And, I mean, you know, I wish I was a big commercial success. And, you know, had a heap of money. But the thing is, I've invested everything back. It's always gone back to, you know, whatever I do, or community or the next project and everything else. So, you know, hopefully one day I will get to that spot, and that's, you know, that slowing down period about giving myself now time to get into the commercial space of this, because I've created the other side of it, and yeah, start looking after my family, my Jarjums and everybody else. So it's a big responsibility in the end, I think, for all of us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think I always think about what is the story that future generations will speak about us? What will the story be? Will it be that we worked to reclaim our connections with native foods, and that we've, you know, shared that knowledge with the rest of Australia? And have they reciprocated that by acknowledging that we have had a right to speak for our country, to work for our country, and to have economic opportunity from our native foods? And what will that look like? You know, what's going to be the story that our grandchildren speak about us in that relationship? Will they be the ones that are making, for example, a healthy puffed granola of gunnelay and gooey with macadamia nuts and dried lily pillies? Like, how beautiful would that be to eat that instead of wheat, which is combined with lots of sugar, is no good for our mob? You know, so I think about that. What can we set up today? And what we do today, we may not, what's going to come, but you've got a vision to leave something better for our children.
Look, Sharon, you mentioned a little earlier about the native food industry being, I think you said, about 2% black owned. Oh. It's an industry that's worth more than $80 million. I mean, how do we actually keep Aboriginal ownership at the forefront of this industry and of as it grows?
Yeah, it's a big question, and that we need a whole day to talk about that. But for me, being involved in lots of different levels of things now, like with the First Nations Bush Food Botanical Alliance, I'm a director of that organisation, and working with Raylene and Annie Pat from the Kimberley and other women across the country. And so really trying to get to the higher, you know, government talks, discussions about how they can support our people and our communities with expanding what they already have on country. And so our people, there's lots of our people right across the country that are growing or harvesting or, you know, doing things in the native food industry, and they need some support. And it's about helping people find where they can go direct to buy, purchase from community, from our people. And it's not as if, you know, I've never said that I don't like, and I don't think that non-Aboriginal people should be in the native food space, but we just want people to acknowledge and pay respects to where that knowledge that they're using to promote their products comes from, and just acknowledging our people, engaging with our people, our community where they can, and having good relationships.
Yeah, I think ownership's a really big one, because I know, you know, over the decades you get ripped off your knowledge, you get ripped off from this and that and the other, and the thing is you just keep going. And you know these people that do come on board on that wave of everybody else's success sucks. It really does. But the thing is, you just keep going and you just keep your head up and just keep creating and getting smarter as you're getting along, but also making alliances as well. You know, Raylene, I've been working with her for a long time. There's Bob Taylor up there in Uluru as well, around Uluru and Alice Springs. And, you know, you got Mitch Torres on the other side in, you know, Broome. All of these people have done different things at different times over the last couple of decades, you know. And I think it's now starting to get into this movement. But like Sharon said, it has to be acknowledged where it comes from. Who's put in and what communities are put in the hard yards? Because, you know, you've got these big corporates now that have come in and bought up the big farms to put into their botanicals. So that sucks. It should be, a portion of that should be commercial. You know, this is thinking outside of the box, you know, when they're doing all of this sort of stuff, that, okay, these are uniquely Australian, so a portion of that farming practice should be commercially available, not just sent to, you know, to make shampoo and creams. And same with the macadamias, all of that sort of stuff. You know, people for years thought it was from Hawaii or crap. It was from Bundjalung country, you know. So telling these stories as well, I think, closes that gap for a lot of people, but it gives it, you know, it's for the future, for the kids especially, a grounding of where these foods come from, but also acknowledge elders and people that have come through that have really championed this, and, you know, pay that respect, but also for the non-Indigenous to actually step up as well and start acknowledging just the practices of what country it comes from, or, you know, things like that.
And I think too, Mark, that protection, you know, the protection around the knowledge, the protection around language, where are First Nations peoples involved? Are they a part of the process from the beginning all the way through to the end? And do they have permissions? And then how do we think about acknowledging the place where those foods come from. So like you said, the macadamia nuts, people thought they were from overseas, but they are specific to place in the same way other, fruits are specific to a place, in the same way the native grains are specific to a particular country.
Exactly.
You know, they use the term like a geographical indicator of that place, right? So they're the important stories that need to be told and need to be held by the people in that country and of that country. And so we need to think about that so that we keep the integrity and we keep the truth of the stories for each First Nations community and their country. Yeah.
Mark, you mentioned The Midden. That is your restaurant that has recently, in the last year, has opened at Sydney Opera House.
We opened on NAIDOC Week last year.
I actually went along. It was, it's lovely.
Oh, look, we've been so fortunate. And, I've just been so blessed to be gifted this and with the group that I'm working with. Again, it's been great to be creative and working with people that are and non-Indigenous and Indigenous, but people from all around the world that work at that opera house that are so curious. Because the story of that midden, it's a story, you know. And they said when they came to me, they said, Mark, what do you want to name your restaurant? I said, well, Midden. And my first restaurant I had in 95, 96, was called The Midden. That was in Pitt Street. Up here, way ahead of its time, like I mentioned. But they said, what do you want to call it? I said, The Midden. That's interesting. Well, do you know the story? Well, when they dug out the opera house and they dug it down to get out the car park and everything, they dug out over 10 metres of shells, and each metre was estimated to be nearly 1,000 years old. So, you know, these are shells and bones and plant matter and everything over the last 40,000 years or 10,000 years that was estimated all of those shells on Bennelong Point because it was the only place they ate. Nowhere else along that side. So that was the story why I called it The Midden, and it's become the story now of the Opera House, which is nice. So is it another level?
I think that relationship that you have with your non-Indigenous counterparts really shows how things can work well together. And, you know, if it's done properly, it can work as well. So
it's about education. Yeah. But it shouldn't have taken bloody 50 years.
No, that's right.
Well, because it's also about respect.
Oh, yeah. Totally. Mm. And, you know, and I think now the whole swing of it now has been really good. And Louise, the CEO there, is just so amazing. Yeah. Mm. Makes it more inclusive and I think brings more of the Indigenous story of it.
What's the one thing you wish more people knew or understood about native food?
I think for people just to have an open mind and give it a try, learn something and, yeah, at least just have an open mind to learning something.
My whole career has been about it, you know, right from the very get-go. Ever since I was a kid cooking at 9, it's always been there, and then doing my apprenticeship and then, you know, in the 70s and then coming out and doing all of that stuff. I mean, back in the day, the big thing was for me in learning and on the scene at that time was, prawn cocktails. You know, that was one of the big things in the late 70s, you know, to be making and all of these souffles and stuff like that, because it has changed. Food has changed over the decades as well, and the different styles, and coming into the 80s with the Nouvelle Cuisine and how that all changed. But not only that, how Sydney opened up with its restaurants as well. In the early 80s, you had all the Spanish area in Liverpool Street popping up. You had the Greek sections everywhere. So it was an interesting time. And to see it grow now to where it was and to have more Indigenous inclusivity all around the city, we need more.
Priscilla?
I think for me, I'd like people to consider where that food has come from, what is the story of it, and how might you give back to Mother Earth through the planting of native foods. You know, how could, if everyone planted something in their garden, how that would regenerate the earth and then also regenerate your spirit, you know. I just think about that relationship and how we can get people to be more in a right relationship with the foods of these lands?
Oh, look, I've been talking to the mob down at home and a lot of the councilmen down there too. I'd like to see lemon myrtle trees along the walkways or just in the parks or, you know, quandong trees. Up. I remember growing up and there were like, we had blackberry bushes everywhere, you know, and yeah, if they started, councils started, physically started putting these natives in, it wouldn't be such a problem, you know, to have an avenue of lemon myrtles, of aniseed myrtles or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's just being, yeah, getting the councils and getting, you know, those fellows on board.
To finish up, I would really love to know, what are you looking forward to eating this long weekend?
Oh, well, always love eating seafood. And, you know, you growing up, never eat bacon or meat on good... Well, sorry, we didn't create Good Friday. We were eating bacon on Friday. And a lamb chop. But, you know, seafood's always good, you know. All of that sort of stuff. And I love crustaceans, love crab, anything seafood really, oysters. I can eat a dozen by myself. But up and down the south coast, there's lots of urchins, sea urchin. And the tongue in the urchin is quite different if you don't, you know what it's like or tastes like, but it's really, really salty, really, really nice. And I do like that on a crudité type thing. But it's almost like a caper, you know, and an anchovy. So together, texturally. But it's, yeah, different, very different sea urchins. I do like them. I love abalone. What about you girls?
I'm a muddy river person. I love my freshwater fish, yabbies, mud crabs. Usually for me, for Easter though, it's time to just not do anything really except for get out bush and take time out and go sit on the river with family, and that's kind of what Easter is for me.
So my plan is to, in Gomeroi we say maramaldana, which means to be making. Mara means your hands. To be making with your hands. So my intention would be to definitely make Johnny cakes and I think some yabbies on the coals and getting that beautiful little smoky hint that you get from the coals. I think that's going to be my my meal, and I might even throw in a lamb cutlet or lamb chops on the grill too, Mark.
I love a lamb cutlet.
Bit of mix, you know.
Yeah.
Well, thank you all so much for sharing your knowledge, sharing your time. This has been such a lovely chat for me and quite an education as well. So thank you.
No, thank you. To all our listeners, have a great day.
Thank you.
That was Chef Mark Olive, education consultant and creative Priscilla Reid-Loynes, and founder of Indigi Earth, Sharon Windsor. This is Away, Indigenous Art and Culture on ABCRN. And it's time now for Word Up. For one more week, we're headed to the East Kimberley region to meet up with Shay Kelly. Shay is a Mirrawong man and he's been our language legend for the past month, sharing his knowledge and passion for his language. But what you probably don't know about Shay is that he's got spectacular hair. Seriously. So that's the Mirrawong word he's sharing this week. Hair.
Bukulba means happy.
Word Up, bringing you the diverse languages of Black Australia, one word at a time.
Kinagai.
Birluin.
Walter.
Kalang.
Badjali.
Ngalungir.
Bambach.
Dianye.
Injamara.
Guram.
Mijal.
Ripiri.
Ngaraguchainama.
Gani Warangung.
Munyip.
Dominianka, Wakaniniana,
Wardadoia,
Wundingi Dangan,
Wukuk,
Kuwayu,
Delkup,
Tiepa,
Murupuk.
Hi, my name is Shay Kelly. The position I got, I'm a language engagement officer, so a teacher as well. The name of the language center I work at, it's Mirama Dawang Wulapgiring. This is a place for talking. Yambarang. Your hair, what you brush. It's another everyday word. Everyone say it. I chose that word because Yambarang, I love Yambarang because I love my hair. And it's straight. Because I come across a lot of people, you know, they always say this to me. Shay, I love your hair so much. It's just, it's not too thick. It's not too thin. It's just all right. You know? Right now I have ponytail on. One thing I love about my hair is when I do cut it, in a year it just grows back just like that. Like, you know, for most people that it takes. So it seems like as I was growing up, I kept my hair healthy. Language is really important. Don't ever forget that. It's really good that I shared my language to encourage other language speakers to keep their language alive. And it's really good speaking language to communicate with your family members and the people who speak that language around you. And it's good to have your language within you because you talk to country and country will respond back to you. Hello, this is Shay. Thank you for listening to my 5 words in Miro. This is going to be the last time you hear my voice.
Word Up, bringing you the diverse languages of Black Australia, one word at a time.
That was our language legend for this month, Shay Kelly, sharing some Mirawang from Kununurra in the East Kimberley region. You can hear the full series of Word Up on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. And that's our program for this week. Away is produced on Gadigal Country by Mia Hull and me, Rudy Brummer. Technical production today by Tegan Nichols. We're back next week, but you can catch us anytime when you tune in and subscribe on the app. ABC Listen. Until then, here's a little music from Inverell rappers T-Breezy and Walker Boy. The pair have just released a joint mixtape, South's Most Wanted, that celebrates their ambitions, their art, and their love of their community. This one is called Alone.
I've been natty on the road trying to find my way home. Take another flight just to do another show. I've been steady on my grind and I've been doing it alone. And I ain't never gonna stop until they put me on the throne. But I ain't worried about the fame, only worried about the dosh. Just trying to stack it up cause I ain't never had a lot. Ever since a young and I was chilling on the block. And now I'm steady on my grind trying to make it to the top. I've been running up the bag, I've been stacking up them bins. I know haters getting mad, but as fuck them, I don't care. I don't think they understand, I'm just trying to cop a Benz. Now I'm steady making moves, can't be worried about a friend. Cause ever since a young and I've been trying to chase a dream. Stacking up the cash, taking flights overseas. So I've been making moves every day of the week. Steady running up the board, they can't do it like me. With a pocket full of dreams, I was running up the bag. Went from flipping on the corner, now it's pockets full of cash. I'ma stay up on my grind, I ain't never going back. I'ma stay up on my hustle, put my city on the map. Cause I've been natty on the road, trying to find my way home. Take another flight just to do another show. I've been steady on my grind and I've been doing it alone. And I ain't never gonna stop until they put me on the phone. But I ain't worried about the fame, only worried about the dosh.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.